types of investigations using biomedical signal analysis where you don't simply record the ECG with the patient lying on a bed, but you get the patient to, you make the patient go through some routines or maneuvers or fairly strenuous exercises and put stress on the system, in particular the cardiovascular system, and see what happens within certain limits when the patient is stressed and the system is stressed. Is there a change in the ECG? Is there a change in the performance of the heart? This can be done using the ECG during exercise and after exercise. There is a resting ECG obtained first to serve as a reference. And after exercise, the patient may also be imaged using nuclear medicine techniques where a radioactive isotope is injected and the distribution of that radioactive isotope is measured using a gamma camera or imaged using a gamma camera, because the patient's heart will then be emitting gamma rays from the concentration of the radiopharmaceutical. So you get a picture of the ventricles or the blood pool within the ventricles. And to do this, all of this, to study the performance of the cardiovascular system during exercise, you need to monitor the ECG, the heart rate, and also measure changes in ST segment, because myocardial ischemia, which leads to reduced blood supply to a certain part of the cardiac musculature, may worsen the situation during stress when the subject is exercising or the heart rate goes up beyond 120 or 140, then the ischemic region would indicate a larger change in the ECG than during resting conditions. So for that purpose, it is important to study the changes in the ST segment in the ECG during exercise. So Sia and others, they did ECG analysis, and also they did this as part of radionuclide ventriculography, which is called gated blood pool imaging using nuclear medicine imaging techniques. And there, I'll come to that in a moment. I'll get to that later. Nuclear medicine images are obtained of the left ventricle before and after exercise on a treadmill or bicycle ergometer. So you get a picture first, and then the patient does something and goes back into the scanner, and you get another picture or series of images of the ventricle. The images are obtained at different phases of the cardiac cycle by gating the radionuclide, the gamma ray, emission data with the ECG. And the image data for each phase will be averaged over several cardiac cycles. I need to switch here. Let's see. I'm pretty sure I loaded it here. Please give me a moment. How do I go to the... Oh, it must be here. So what is done in gated blood pool imaging to synchronize the acquisition of frames of the emission data is that the ECG is obtained simultaneously, and you have to detect QRS. So this is a real-life application of QRS detection. And having detected the QRS, you break the time duration of data acquisition into windows of a certain number of milliseconds, so that within each R to R interval, you get 8 or 16 frames. So you find the RR interval first and divide that by 8 or 16, and then break the cardiac cycle into as many parts. Here I have illustrated 8. The need for this is the fact that if you were to take an image using a nuclear medicine imaging system, such as a gamma camera, and if you take a picture over several beats over 2-3 minutes to get good quality of the image, then several cardiac cycles would have gone through, and the picture that you get of the heart is essentially useless. Some other part of the body, such as the thyroid, you can do the photon counting for several minutes and get a good picture. And that's not a problem. And you need to count the photons over several minutes, because you need to overcome the Poisson noise associated with photon counting, which is a random event. In the case of imaging of the heart, if you wait for 5-10 minutes and do the counting, the patient would have gone through 500 cardiac cycles and you get a blurry picture of the entire heart, which is totally useless. So instead, you count the photons in intervals that break the cardiac cycle into phases. So you need the ECG as a trigger, and you say this is the, if you detect the QRS, you say that is the initiation of contraction. This is ventricular contraction at the maximum level. This is after QRS, the T wave, or phases of contraction. And then after this here, you label that as diastole, and you label the next one as atrial contraction, and so on. You can break the cardiac cycle into parts that are synchronized with the cardiac cycle. So ventricular contraction will be here, and then atrial contraction will be, where is the P wave? That one. This is atrial contraction, and so on. And each of the emission data from the gamma ray camera in this interval will be sent to one image, in this to the next image, and so on. And for the next cardiac cycle, in the same phase, you send the count data to this image, and that interval to this image, and so on, and keep adding over several cardiac cycles. And then you get good pictures with good statistics and noise reduced of each cardiac phase separately. And you can run this as a movie many times. Run through a loop, and you see the heart beating. But of course, this is an average over several cardiac cycles. Each one is an average over multiple cardiac cycles. In doing this, you also have to recognize quite often the patients who come here for such studies will have some cardiovascular problems, such as ischemia, could possibly have ectopic beats during stress. And in the case of ectopic beats, you do not want the counts to come into these frames because you don't have a proper reference and it's not a complete cardiac cycle. So the count data, the gamma ray photons that are emitted during ectopic beats will be rejected and will not be accumulated in these images. So that is what Sia and others built into their system. Could we turn the lights off this one? I'm sorry? No, not this. The other one. Okay. So here are 6 frames of the nuclear medicine images where you see the left ventricle large. This is the left ventricle large, becoming smaller, and the smallest here and then expanding again. So this is over one cardiac cycle. I only got 6 frames here. If you were to take this over only 10 milliseconds, you won't see anything. This will be just totally random noise. After averaging over 16 cardiac cycles, these images were obtained, which are fairly good. If you average over more cardiac cycles, you could get better quality, but this apparently is what they use at the Foothills Hospital in Calgary. Each picture here is only 64 by 64 pixels. So the spatial resolution is very poor of the gamma camera imaging unit. But that is, again, adequate. And they can measure the amount of radionuclide present in the chamber, in the left ventricles, by averaging the counts in this area by segmenting it. And it's possible to also measure how much of that blood is ejected during systole and how much remains at the end of systole. So you get a performance measure as to how well the left ventricle is contracting. And you can run these frames as a movie repeatedly and see what happens with the heart. To do this, you need ECG for gating. A commercial from my other book. This is in my other book. All right. The analysis of exercise ECG is more complicated than analysis of resting ECG because baseline artifacts are caused by effects of respiration, perspiration, skin resistance changes, the electrodes move or may become loose and so on. And the soft tissue beneath the electrodes will also move because the patient is not just at rest. So detection of changes in the ST segment in the presence of such artifacts is not easy. What they did is they did a correlation coefficient. Now these are simple signal processing techniques, but they have found practical use. In this book, I have given several examples where very basic techniques have found good use in practice. So we have seen correlation so many times. Here you see it once more. The same idea, small differences. The main parameter used by CI and others was a correlation coefficient, gamma xy that we saw earlier. We had written this as xn, yn, and xn squared and yn squared here, but they put a minus delta there to correct for baseline. Xn is the template, yn is the new beat that you're analyzing, and you want to ask the question, what is the difference between this beat and my normal template? Is it significantly different? And the new beat may have shifted in baseline, so they estimate the baseline and then subtract it. But for the template that was taken earlier, you don't have to change anything. So delta is a baseline correction factor equal to the difference between the baseline of yn and the baseline of xn. And n is the duration of the template and the new beat that you have cut, and they are assumed to be of the same duration. And there is a normalization factor here, the geometric mean of the energies in the two signals. If you remember, Jenkins and others also use the same to encode each beat using the atrial signal as a reference. We saw that in chapter 2. So the template was generated by averaging up to 20 QRS complexes that met a certain specified RR interval constraint and considered to be normal. And gamma XY less than 0.85 was labeled as an abnormal beat. And the count data in gamma imaging, the photon count data during those beats were not used. So beats with abnormal morphology, such as PVCs, were rejected and rejected in the imaging procedure. But they would have been noted for sure as abnormal beats. The ST reference point was defined as R plus 64 milliseconds and some correction factor due to heart rate, or S plus 44 milliseconds and some other correction factor. So these are the positions of the R or S in the present beat in milliseconds, and HR is the heart rate. And elevation or depression of the ST segment by more than 0.1 millivolt with reference to the baseline was reported by this program. I think there is a correction required in the book. If you see the updates, the number I gave at this position in the book is not correct. So please refer to the updates just for that section, that number. I think I put 2 millivolts or something like that, which is not correct. The whole ECG is only 1 millivolt. Okay, let me just quickly see what I have here. It's only 1 hour, so let's keep going. We'll finish this and where was I? There. Okay. There are just two more items. We'll finish in 10 minutes. We'll take a break at 10:30. A couple more applications. Analysis of respiration. This was the work of Ron Platt, I mentioned earlier. They wanted to develop a method to relate EMG activity to airflow during inspiration. And this was with the dog. In the case of the dog, they could put the snout, a pneumotachograph, and measure the airflow. But in the case of human beings, I don't think anybody would want to walk around with this or keep a snout mask to measure airflow. So if you can get a different surrogate measure from an EMG, that would be useful. But in this case, the EMG was obtained by implanting wires. In the case of a human subject, you may not be able to do that unless the subject is undergoing surgery for some other purpose. Otherwise, you would want to substitute this for a surface or with a surface EMG. Anyway, Platt and others recorded EMG signals from the parasternal, intercostal, and crural diaphragm muscles of dogs, and then said there should be a relationship between these signals and the breathing, the respiration rate in terms of how much air is going in. The EMG signal obtained from a pair of electrodes mounted at a fixed distance of 2 millimeters placed between fibers in the third left parasternal intercostal muscle and about 2 centimeters from the edge of the sternum. That is where they put the electrodes. They also put in the crural diaphragm. The crural EMG was obtained via fine wire electrodes sewn in line with the muscle fibers and placed 10 millimeters apart. The dog breathed through a snout mask. I saw this experiment, in fact. And the pneumotachograph measured the airflow. In order to obtain a measure from the EMG, they didn't use RMS, but they used the envelope. I showed a plot earlier of turns count, RMS, and envelope of the same EMG of the dog. And Ron Platt, he used the EMG envelope, and then they used the full-wave rectifier, and then they applied a modified Bessel filter that severely attenuated frequencies beyond 20 hertz with a gain of less than minus 70 dB. A simple moving average filter will not give you that. So they used a Bessel filter. You could possibly design other filters, but they found the Bessel filter to give the best result. And compared to what I showed earlier, these are much better results. So here are 2 breath cycles of the parasternal intercostal muscle, increasing activity of the EMG with inspiration. And the middle is the EMG envelope. Let's see. Yeah, this is after Bessel filter. So there are some little artifacts, but it is better than what I showed earlier. There is a clear trend going up and coming down. And this is the airflow signal at the bottom. The total duration is 5 seconds. These small peaks apparently are related to the ECG in some cases. The ECG comes in and could corrupt the EMG signal because the diaphragm is so close to the heart. It is possible, if you get the ECG, detect the ECG separately using some other reference, you can do adaptive cancellation or correct for these, but they didn't do that. So they took the values from the filtered envelope and the corresponding value from the pneumotachograph related to volume of air, and then did a correlation. So this is the filtered EMG amplitude, and this is airflow in liters per second, and these are all the samples in those signals, and there is good correlation. So you could, in later applications with this coefficients that represent this relationship, you may apply just the EMG and predict or compute the airflow in liters per second without the pneumotachograph. There are electrical and mechanical correlates of muscle contraction that we have seen, the EMG and VMG, the vibromyogram and the electromyogram. So a problem that we considered, Y.T. Zhang, who was a postdoctoral fellow with me many years ago and is now with the Chinese University of Hong Kong, we considered the problem of deriving parameters from the electrical and mechanical manifestations of muscular activity and then study the correlation between them. Can one be used to predict the parameters of the other? What is the relationship? And related to force. So we studied the usefulness of simultaneously recorded EMG and VMG signals in the analysis of muscular force. In this study, subjects performed isometric contraction of the rectus femoris muscle against a Cybex 2 dynamometer that measured the level of torque. Four levels of contraction were applied or used to record the signals, 20, 40, 60, and 80% of the maximal voluntary contraction level. So So each subject had to establish what is the maximum contraction possible, note that, and repeat later several observations or several sessions of contraction being held at 20, 40, 60, and 80% of that maximum level. In between, the subject would be given rest so that the subject wouldn't develop fatigue, because then the characteristics of the signals would be different. So these sessions were repeated many times, and the parameters of the signals were computed and averaged. They were also repeated at three knee joint angles of 30, 60, and 90 degrees, and this was related to the muscle contraction interference that we wanted to cancel from the knee joint vibration also. So we wanted to characterize a few different things. So each contraction was held for 6 seconds, and there was rest provided to prevent muscle fatigue. The VMG was recorded using an accelerometer. Surface EMG signals were recorded using silver chloride electrodes. The VMG signals were filtered 3 to 100 hertz, the EMG 10 to 300 hertz, and they were sampled at 250 and 1000 hertz. We just used RMS values. You could compute a few other parameters such as Stern's count too, but for the VMG, we thought for the vibration signal from the muscle, we thought that RMS would be appropriate for each contraction over 5 seconds. And we got linear trends for the RMS values of both the EMG and the VMG with muscle contraction, that is force, at those levels of contraction. So these signals are both useful in muscular activity, in the analysis of muscular activity, and that is our conclusion from this study. However, the EMG-RMS versus force relationships vary from muscle to muscle. There are previous studies that have shown that. So here is the result from our study. EMG-RMS values and VMG-RMS values and increasing level of contraction at 20, 40, 60, and 80% of the maximal voluntary contraction for each subject. So this is, which is which? Let's see. What is there? The thick line is EMG and the thin line is the VMG. So they both have similar or comparable relationship with force, and it is almost linear except for this at the beginning. Whereas for other muscles, DeLuca and others have shown that in some cases the relationship could be nonlinear. This is RMS, and this is a number of subjects over which these relationships have been averaged. And this is for the biceps, this is the deltoid, and this is the first dorsal interosseous muscle. And in this case, it is linear, but for the biceps, it is definitely nonlinear. And this is percent of maximal voluntary contraction of force. So depending upon the muscle you are studying, you may or may not get a linear relationship between force or the level of contraction and a measure such as the RMS value of the EMG or the VMG. But they both could be used depending upon the kind of experimentation and the situation. In some cases, it may be more advantageous to get one of the signals and not the other, or that depends again. So the EMG and the VMG may or may not be simultaneously recorded, but in some cases it may be preferable and convenient to get the EMG, and in some other cases the VMG. And what we are showing, what we showed in this example, is that both can serve the purpose. I think that ends this chapter. Okay. Any questions on what we have seen so far? If not, we'll take a break. We'll take a break for 10 minutes.